Accessing library computer data.
The world doesn't always adhere to logic. And sometimes when you're lost, you're found.
Hey everybody, welcome back to our continuing coverage of Star Trek Discovery. Right now, we're up to the 8th episode of the 2nd season. It's called If Memory Serves. It first aired on the 7th of March, 2019, written by Dan Dworkin and Jay Beatty, or Beatty, Jay Beatty, directed by T.J. Scott. In this episode, Spock and Burnham head to Talos IV, where the process of healing Spock forces the siblings to confront their troubled past. Stamets desperately tries to reconnect with an increasingly disconnected Hugh, while Tyler struggles to shed the crew's suspicions of him due to his past life as Voke. We're joined by Clay, as always. Clay, how are you?
Wes, this is not Clay. Clay quit last episode.
Oh, that's
right. This is just the mental projection of Clay. Or Clay from the future, whatever you feel like. I'm good.
The red Clay.
The red Clay.
There's a little bit too much of a communist reference there, I think. But the I think that,
I have a mustache for it, though.
And you do love sculptures and statues of yourself. They adorn your residence.
Specifically of myself. Yes, yeah.
We're going to be talking about If Memory Serves, which is the first big Spock episode. We've got a lot to talk about, I think. So we're just going to get to it. I'm going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back. We're going to break down If Memory Serves.
It began the night he ran away from our home. Deep into the forest of Vulcan's Forge and its many dangers. That is when the angel first appeared to me. I thought it was a dream. A premonition. It showed me your death.
All right, so here's my experience with this one, Clay. I enjoyed watching this episode to the point where I was watching it going, is this like the first good Discovery episode of the season where I was really happy with it? Then I went online and everyone hated it. So I don't know what I'm supposed to think. I kind of like this one. This was the first episode I would say that I was actually actively engaged by, which is not to say that it's really perfect or that it really deviates from what Discovery does, but I was sort of wrapped the entire time. I was like, when it ended, I was kind of like, oh, like I didn't look at my watch the entire time there. I didn't sort of fade out. Like it held my attention in a way that the show sometimes has difficulty doing. And I think what that is, this was the first episode that I thought the script, at least in terms of like structure and pacing, felt like a real TV episode to me.
Yeah.
It had multiple stories, but I felt it moved between them all fairly well, and it conveyed information in a way that the show sometimes has difficulty doing. And it, you know, despite all the other problems with it, I was really like, you know, I'm kind of enjoying all these character moments, and I'm kind of enjoying this time that the show is spending with characters that it usually doesn't do. And maybe just because of that, I'm overrating it in my mind. But I did think it was noticeable. What did you think?
Well, allow me to see your overrating and add one. I think character-wise, this might be the best episode of the entire series.
Yeah. The other great episode, I think, is, if not great, it's the Magic to Make the Sanus Mango Mad, which is basically a concept episode.
And yeah, it doesn't that's a concept work. Episode. Yeah, yeah. Right. You know, the thing that we've been critical of the most this season, well, and last season, is character work and a lot of, like, haphazard storylines and all that kind of stuff. And I think this episode has... This is the first episode that I've seen where dramatic scenes with two characters don't feel forced and actually feel like they are character driven. Like the scene with Culber and Stamets when they're having dinner might be the straight up best two person scene they've done so far in the whole series. Because they're building off of their relationship without, you know, force feeding you shit. They are taking the concept that they've brought into this situation and exploring it with two characters that have differing viewpoints who are expressing it. And it was just, I thought it was great. There was no ham-fisted resolution to that storyline, which was nice. Every scene, you know, Pike continues to be a high point. Every scene where it was actually two characters talking for the most part, was really strong. I didn't love... So I thought the Talosian stuff was fine. Like, going to the planet, I didn't have a problem with that. Even though somehow the makeup looks worse now than it did in the 60s. I don't know how that's possible. But
they also didn't stick with the casting all women, which I was disappointed by. They cast a man as the
like
lead
two
one.
Women and Frank Stallone, I think. But I didn't love that stuff mainly because it was like, I need this information from Spock. And they're like, well, if you want this information, first you're going to have to give us something. We would like you to tie up a plot thread that we haven't really addressed yet.
I even thought it was creepier than that. They're like, we like to jerk off to really bad emotions. Like, they were really interested in what she had to say. It was clunky. I mean, if we... The big takeaway I wanted to talk about, which we could talk in sort of like broad strokes about the Cage thing, was who is this show written for? Like, who...
Yeah.
I actually found the Talosian and the Cage stuff fairly good in terms of like how ham-fisted some of the, if you want to be cynical and call it fan service, or if you want to say like homages to previous stuff. I thought that they were actually pretty okay, and just in the fact that their ability to cure Spock makes sense in what we know of them. Like, that's the only thing we know about them, and it makes sense that they would go to this previous place where these people could do this for him. However, The downside of it is that they, because they're so one note in this appearance, and I doubt we're going to see them going forward, it feels kind of clunky at the same time. And I think this is just one of those episodes, like they had to put that opening cutscene of the Cage clips to be like, this is all stuff that people like previously existed. Because I think if you don't know Star Trek and you don't know the unaired TOS pilot that aired 50 years ago, and you're unfamiliar with Pike, the Talosian stuff must be a whole bunch of nonsense to you. Like, none of this must really amount to anything. It must just seem like such deus ex machina.
Well, so my problem, I know why they did the clip show thing at the beginning, but I honestly don't think that was the best way to handle that stuff. Cause I didn't go back and watch the clip thing again, but I don't really feel like you learned anything from that you didn't learn in the episode, other than, oh, Pike had been here before.
Right.
So I don't see any reason why you couldn't have just worked that into the body of the show without having to do a kind of cheesy, tongue in cheek, we're going to show you clips from the original pilot thing.
I think they're a little stuck because Pike does not go to Talos, which is the kind of questionable thing, in my opinion. Like,
yeah,
I don't know if he needed to, but he's really the only character that sticks out there. I mean, Spock, she knows Spock. Vina knows Spock. And Spock is familiar with them. But Pike is really the dramatic edge of that story. And to make Pike work here, they insert a relationship with Vina that I don't think he really has from the Cage. Like, it's pretty empty emotional scenes between Vina and Pike in this episode, because he doesn't really have a lot going on. He can't go there. He can barely talk to them. He doesn't have a story that's invested there. So the Cage stuff, like showing him at the beginning, is actually kind of interesting. If only just because it ties the show into canon. Like, you can no longer say this is a different universe. Like, it's literally the same thing. And I don't know. I thought that the Talosians made sense. It pleased me as sort of a fan who's familiar with the series. But at the same time, I don't know if this is really good writing that you should do it like this. Because if you don't know who these people are, it seems like just a whole bunch of nonsense that's going on. They met these random telepathic aliens who can fix Spock's brain.
Yeah. I don't love it. I think you could have explained it better in the body of the show, I think. Especially when you do have Pike in this position of being sort of this emotional crux for the episode, or at least plot crux at the end. If you take out that beginning scene where it's like, oh, Pike's been here before, Pike doesn't even really talk about the place.
No.
Like, there's no scene where he's conflicted about going there, or, you know, he's not talking with Saru. Like, the closest thing they have is when he sets the course in, and they're like, hey, we're not supposed to go there. And he's like, yeah, I know. I'm the reason. He doesn't say this, but the implication is I'm the reason that you're not supposed to go there.
Right.
I think it would have been more beneficial for the story that they were telling to get that stuff across, because otherwise it doesn't really come across.
Yeah.
And you are relying on stuff that you know coming into it, which, as we've said before, if you want to be really, if you want to be as coming at it from a new viewer standpoint, which honestly you should, like, I know what you're saying, who's the show for? I think you should be able to, when you're doing a show like this, you should be able to walk that line where you're presenting stuff, old stuff that old fans will know, in a way that they will know it, but also be relatable for people who are just seeing it for the first time.
Right.
You know, like, I forget who was, I think it was Joe Quesada, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, said every comic book is somebody's first comic book. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, you should be able to have something in there that they can grasp onto, where you can go, okay, I get what's going on. So they can, you know. And I don't think having that clip show at the beginning really does that, because it doesn't answer these questions. It just says, oh, he's been there before. And maybe that's enough. I don't know. Maybe they thought that was enough. I think it would have been more satisfying if they had kept it within the body of this show, of the show they're doing now, and figured out a way to tell you that stuff organically.
Yeah, because I think it does make sense for Spock to go there to fix his brain. Like, I think that's a good enough reason for him to go there. The problem outside of that is that the Talosians don't have a story to themselves here. It's right. Not like there's anything going on with them. They just exist as this sort of plot mechanic to fix Spock, and they tie into this fan servicey canon thing where you know these guys already. So going there really just serves them as a plot device. Like, they don't have a, it's not like the Cage episode where the whole thing was about, like, whether or not humans want to be free or live in cages, and the Talosians didn't understand the difference, and that was kind of the drive of the episode.
Yeah, and they were pretty chill about it here.
Yeah. And what's also funny is in the Cage, the weakness they have is strong emotions, which is what Pike fights back against them with. They don't like anger. And here they request Burnham to get angry at them.
Hey, they're just trying to build up a tolerance, I guess.
you got to build up a little bit. It's like fentanyl. I think that's basically the main problem with the Talosian stuff is that it, while I think there's nothing really overtly wrong with it, it doesn't really end up amounting to much beyond, like, something you could have probably gotten another scene by going to a medical sick bay or something. It makes sense in context and everything, but at the same time, I don't know, like, it's too obvious their mechanics, and I think that if you're unfamiliar with it, it's just such a bizarre reach. The clip show at the start is, honestly, the thing I got most out of the clip show is how, I think his name's Jeffrey Hunter, the guy who played Pike originally, was really just kind of a black hole of a character actor. Yeah, he's not really very good. Shatner obviously destroyed him and took over the role as Kirk, but Anson Mount is just doing a much better job with Pike than Hunter did in his one episode.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Anson Mount continues to be the high point for me. Every scene that he's in, he's fantastic. Like, he feels like a Star Trek captain should.
He's also pleasant compared to the rest of them in a way. He has the scene with where Saru allows Culber and Ash Vok to fight each other, and he kind of chides him, but he's just like, yeah, make sure this doesn't happen again. He's an interestingly pleasant captain that we've never had.
Yeah. He's probably a little more Kirk than Picard. Yes. I think Picard probably would have been a little harsher in that situation. But I don't know if the writing is better for him, or if it's just he's a good enough actor where he can just sell it better.
I think it's sheer performance.
Yeah, everything with him I've really enjoyed. As far as the Talosian stuff goes, like, I don't mind it in principle. I think it's clunky to the way that they kind of pulled it out. And I think how do you feel? Like, should we talk about the big secret split between Spock and Burnham?
Sure.
Because I don't know how it feels like a long way to go for a ham sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
with that storyline, because they present it as this massive schism, which I guess it was, but also, I don't know, did we really need to take like 15 minutes full of flashbacks in order to tell that story?
No. Was Burnham being mean to her stepbrother something that she wouldn't tell people when they ask? Like, it's not like this, yeah. It's this hidden dark secret. The thing about their reveal is,
I mean,
that,
I could understand, I guess, if you want to really justify that, you could say like, well, you know, Burnham believes that she took away Spock's humanity and she knows how precious that was. So as far as she's concerned, that's the worst possible thing she could have done to him, et cetera, et cetera. But still, it's like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's not that big of a deal.
No.
If you're looking at it from the outside, you know, yep. I don't know. I didn't mean to cut you off.
But they also confirm in that scene that Spock realizes that she did it because it was an act. It was not a legitimate emotion. She was doing it so that he wouldn't follow her where she was going. And so I don't understand why they're still estranged. It's not a big deal. Maybe child Spock would have been impacted by that. But as he's gotten older and realized what the difference was, he should kind of go back. Like, there shouldn't be a rift between them. It's not a big enough issue to cause a rift where they haven't talked to each other in 5 years or whatever it's been.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it would have been kind of more satisfying if the problem was that they actually had talked about it since then, and Spock actually thanked her for it. Mm. And so he was like, you know, hey, I know what you did back then, and I want to thank you because it allowed me to shed my humanity, X, Y, and Z. And that's what made her feel awful, instead of just this thing where they hadn't talked in 15 years, and he's like, no, it was totally fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just wasn't really that satisfying for the buildup they put behind it, which is, you know, par for the course with this show, I suppose.
But. Yeah, I mean, that's the, we've talked about it before. That's my problem with the season-long mystery stuff. Like, the longer you try to string out these mysteries instead of just explaining what they are, the greater the chance of a letdown you have. You know, it's like, if they had brought this up and then said what the problem was in the span of one 50-minute episode, even if the resolution was exactly the same, you wouldn't feel let down by the fact that you watched it for 8 episodes wondering what it could be. And, you know, it would be fine. You'd be like, oh, well, that's not a great writing, but whatever, I can deal with that. And instead, the problem the show has with its continuing mystery thing is that, you know, you're just going to be let down by a lot of the cases that are going to happen. And that's still the big concern for whatever the Red Angel turns out to be in the future.
Yeah, I think... And I think the biggest problem with the Burnham and Spock thing is that it's a mystery based on no knowledge of what the relationship of these characters were at any point.
Right.
Like, we're coming into that mystery, never seeing them interact. And anytime they kind of talk about each other, it's just, or she talks about it, it's like, yeah, it's my brother Spock. But like, you get this mystery of their split without anything to compare it to.
Yep.
When they were showing flashbacks of when they were kids, they weren't like, you know, she wasn't riding him around on her shoulders and they weren't like best friends. Right. It's not like we're getting flashbacks of them being like super, super close. So when you have this fat flashback and she's, you know, telling him to piss off and he's like, but Michael, I love you.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Well, we don't, you're not earning that shit. You know, you've had all of this chance to build this up to make us care about it, but you're just giving us the ending and not giving us any of the meat that makes it worthwhile.
Child Spock is unintentionally hilarious to me too. He makes me laugh when I look at him, which is maybe not fair, but I'd agree. And I think the other big problem is that if you're watching this as a Star Trek fan, you're kind of in your own head having to go, well, Spock didn't mention her for 20 years worth of franchise. Like, there must be some huge relationship rift that happened between these two. Like, it must be a catastrophic, horrible thing that she did that Spock has never mentioned her before. And this is just the, you know, this is the, obviously they've raked Discovery after they did 2S and they didn't have a plan. But if you're doing it as a prequel and you're implying that there's a mystery there, you're kind of implying that the writing is going to take advantage of the fact that there's a huge reason he never mentioned her before.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It doesn't do that. It's very much a letdown.
I can only imagine that Cybok must have been stealing the last of the Cheerios every day for 20 years or something like that, which is why he never mentions him.
Well, he is the heavy set sibling out of all of them. He's definitely the portliest one.
Cybok definitely does seem like the sibling who was just a total prick to him and just like noogieing him all the time and like making fun of him in front of his friends and everything.
Just as Burnham is storming off in their flashback, he's like hitting like a little skate. Oh Jesus, I'm killing myself. What do you call when you play hockey on the ground?
Street hockey.
Street hockey. Like hits in the face. The street hockey. That was a long way to go for a ham sandwich right there. I think. What did you think of Spock? Actually, that's another good place to talk.
I thought he was fine.
Yeah, you know, I thought he was pretty good.
Yeah, he didn't really. I don't really know what you look for in a Spock, to be honest with you, at this point.
It's kind of confusing because you have to remember, like, you need to try to place him in where his development should be, I suppose. Yeah. So in the cage, Spock is funny because he's constantly yelling and needlessly introducing himself to everybody. He constantly tells everybody his name, and he's yelling and he's laughing. So this is post that by 3 years. So he's supposed to be, he's obviously a little bit calmer, and he says in this thing that he like devoted himself to the extremes of logic.
He says that was because of what Burnham did.
What Burnham did, it? Right. So, I mean, that's the kind of, I don't particularly care too much about Spock's developments in a lot of ways, I don't know if it, like, if you were to dig deep on this, I don't know how much his arc really makes sense. It seems like he's kind of up and down at this point, and Discovery's insertion of him here makes it seem even more up and down. But I thought the actor was good. I think that he is, I can kind of see the development from him to TOS 10 years later, where here he's a little bit more sarcastic and rude to people. He clearly seems to think that he is above others. He says some line to Burnham about if your intellect couldn't do it. He makes some quip about her not being up to par with his intellect. And I think that makes sense for a young Vulcan. That's kind of a young Vulcan. I could see that writing making sense. And then 10 years later, when he's on the ship with Kirk, he's kind of more of a mellow version of that.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. Like, I think with Spock, you kind of run into that problem where everybody who's not Leonard Nimoy is going to play him differently. And if you as a viewer have to decide what you want out of your Spock performance, not to say that this guy and Zachary Quinto are like miles away from each other, but this guy plays him a little bit more reserved and laid back, where Zachary Quinto plays him a little bit more Data-ish. Like, his voice has a little bit more inflection to it, and he's a little bit more inquisitive.
Yeah. Quinto, however you pronounce it, his Spock always struck me as a little bit more robotic than I think Spock should be.
Yeah. So I guess that's the question, is like, how do you want your Spock portrayed? And are you just looking for someone to do a Leonard Nimoy impression, or are you looking for someone to take the character and just play it their way? And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer there. But as far as what went in the show, I thought he was pretty good. You know, he didn't,
certainly wasn't bad. There are a lot of bad Vulcan actors, and he's not one of them. And I think the same with the guy who plays Sarek is pretty good at this. Like, I think they play them appropriately in that they obviously have emotions, but they are just being very stoic about it. And I think that's the right way to play them.
Yeah, I think playing a Vulcan is kind of like playing a zombie, where anytime you watch a zombie movie, you can tell the people who don't really know what they're doing are the ones that just walk with their arms out like a Frankenstein monster.
Right.
And then the other ones who actually are like actors who have thought about it are like, you know, kinking their foot to the side, and they've gone through the fact, well, this guy probably died in a car crash, so his hip doesn't work, you know, that kind of thing. So I thought he was good. He's very subdued as far as, yeah, he's His version of a Vulcan is kind of just like my dad, where he's like, you know, he's got emotions, but he's just kind of like more laid back about it and, you know.
Letting it all pass in front of him.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I thought he was pretty good. I'll be curious to see what they do with him for the rest of the season now that he's actively. I feel like the Discovery ship itself is really racking up characters who just stand in the background and comment on stuff.
Yes, yeah.
Like that's kind of what Tyler does. I'm assuming that's what Spock is going to do.
I mean, I thought that's why this episode was impressive, because I felt like everyone was doing something the entire time. Definitely. Like it felt like things were actually going on, and it was probably this is the only episode I felt where Ashvok Tyler amounted to anything. Like he actually had a purpose to being there. But I think the problem is he was clearly inserted to get to this point. Like his whole reason for being on Discovery is to get to this episode where they can sort of betray him or stab him in the back. And I don't know if Section 31, I think Arium is the one that's doing it. So whatever Arium represents is the one that's sort of using him as the one that none on the crew will trust. So Arium can do her sabotaging of the spore drive and stuff so that they can't get there in time.
Yeah, this is another example. I feel like we've talked about this multiple times on this show. I think more so last season than this season so far, where the results that you're watching are not a product of the pieces that got them to that point. So, like, if you're watching this episode and really enjoying the stuff that they're doing with these characters, which I was, I have to kind of divorce myself from everything they've done to get to this point in order to enjoy it.
Right.
Which is not great. You know, ideally you don't do that. But like, you know, the way that they treated Ash here, I thought was really good, really appropriate. I love that they just weren't telling him shit. Mm-hmm. Like he just, instead of him, the last bunch of episodes, he's just on the bridge. This time they were just not telling him when they were doing stuff. So he's always running onto the bridge. Like, what's going on?
There's a lot of people who just run onto the bridge and demand what's going on in the show. I was thinking like a lot of people have no problem running up to Pike in a very interesting way and asking like, oh, they want to talk to him on the bridge and things like that. Yeah. It's much more touchy.
But you know, they actually were writing him as a character who has this history to him, which is going to then have consequences and have people react to him in a certain way, instead of just having him there and then having people sort of slyly mention that that's how people should be acting.
Yes.
So you've had, they're not telling him stuff on the bridge because Pike thinks that he might be a Section 31 mole. Even though to kind of jump to the end here of the Ash discussion, I don't know if he himself, they've totally figured out what his deal is. Maybe this is a result of the way that we got here is not consistent with where we are now, because he was up to this point, wasn't he like whole hog in on Section 31 to the point where he's like, I'm going to go with them over even what you guys say.
Yes. That was my impression of what he's doing.
Yeah. And then in this episode, Pike's having that conversation with him and he's like, no, man, I trust Burnham. I'm only with Section 31 because I have to be and I can do good from inside. That's not how they've been writing him up to this point.
I thought what they were trying to build off and what it didn't really do it because they pivoted to Burnham was that his experience with Pike in the last episode caused him to sort of reconsider things. Like he's now buddies with Pike I was thinking of it.
Yeah. I didn't really buy that.
The Burnham thing is more problematic, and I think that the bigger issue with it is that it's another thing of the show doesn't really do its serialization all that well, because this feels like something that should have been brought up a few times in previous episodes. Like it feels like these are the kind of seeds that you have to sow. The other thing that felt that way was the Culber stuff, where it feels like it's been 5 episodes since Culber came back, and Stamets and him just now are having their first kind of conversation about what this all means.
Yeah,
it just feels like they don't pace things appropriately in terms of like when you see the action happen and what the fallout is for the characters.
Yeah, I think the Culber thing's difficult because you've got so many stories. Like it seems like they're actively doing like 3 storylines at once in every episode. And unfortunately, you've only got so much time to devote to this stuff. And I mean, what was it? Last episode, Culber wasn't even in it.
No, but I thought that this episode was the first one that actually accomplished telling multiple stories at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think they did it well here. But I think the problem is sometimes you don't have the opportunity to touch on these things the way you would like to. Like, I think the Culber and Stamets stuff worked fine because it's like, all right, he's been in sick bay for a week or whatever. I don't know. Sure. Mm-hmm. Fine. So now this is the first point that they're getting to come back. And, you know, I liked that they talked about it as though it was happening for the first time instead of having one of those things where, where he's like, just been like, you've been doing this all week to me. You keep trying to make me eat food. And it's like, well, we don't connect to that. We connect to what we're seeing, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's totally fine for this to be the first interaction where they come back and try to put things back to normal, because that's what you want to see. That's where the meat of the story is.
Yeah.
To go back to Ash for a second. They have him as this the thing with him and Pike, where they're having that talk about Section 31 and stuff, I thought for a second that he was being untruthful. I don't know if that's what they were going for, where he's like putting over the Federation and putting over Burnham to make it look like that he's not in service to Section 31 the way that he claims to be.
Yeah.
Or we think that he is, but that clearly didn't seem to be the case.
No.
But I did like that they have, you know, him trying to say that he's on their side, and then this is the first time that we really saw people not trusting him. Like, they're not telling him when they're doing stuff, so he has to run to the bridge and ask what's going on. You see the scene where Culber gets in his... I actually really liked that stuff. The Culber and Ash stuff, I thought it was great. Because it was actually, like, addressing the situation in a way that was actually had action to it, instead of just other people sort of, like, under their breath reminding people what happened.
Yeah, I don't like everyone in this series knowing kung fu all the time. Is kind of
whatever.
Kind of
I mean,
and I,
everybody in the 60s show could had the same level of fighting
that,
skills.
That's
I'm
true.
Fine if they do.
That's true. Maybe that's a good point. But I think the Culber stuff was fine. It didn't the resolution where they're like, he's like, hey man, I also know what it's like to not be yourself. I thought it was a little stupid or a little bit like unimpressive. And I think that the main problem there is that because we have not spent time with Culber, I sort of don't really get what Culber's deal is. Like he doesn't feel like himself. That's pretty much the extent of it. Like he's like, I feel funny. I don't, things don't taste the same. Colors smell different. Whatever is going on with him, because they're not really exploring it, came across as a little bit bland. And I did like the fact that he confronts Vok or Tyler or whatever you want to call him, but it didn't, I don't know. I thought the whole Culber thing, is probably my least favorite storyline, because I think it feels very melodramatic. And it doesn't have a sort of grounding to it that I think would maybe be more interesting. And I think that those characters are just kind of like, it feels like they're matched together just because the writers sort of realized that their themes are very similar to each other. And it's probably intentional that they're doing it, but it doesn't feel intentional in a deep, meaningful way. It just feels very shallow. It's like, we are both unaware of who we are. Therefore we are now friends again.
Well, I don't know if I would say that they're friends. I actually think the Culber stuff has been good, really good since they brought him back. I still don't know if it was the right decision, because ultimately I don't know where this is going to lead yet. So, but you know, I thought the dinner scene with him and Stamets was good. I really liked the idea. It seemed like character work inside of a science fiction concept, which, you know, God forbid they do that on this show, where he's come back to life, but he is a different being, and he's got Stamets telling him the stuff that he is supposed to like, but then Culber is not seeing it that way because he doesn't know how to deal with it. And then on top of that, he's seeing Ash here, who is the guy who killed him, and their interaction in the mess hall there, I thought made perfect sense. And I thought it was, you know, I don't think that would be something that old Culber necessarily would have done. So the fact that he's actively, aggressively taking it out on Ash, I think is interesting. And I actually really like that, the ending of that fight, where they're not friends, but I think I think Ash expressing that, you know, I don't know who I am either, as a way to kind of diffuse the situation is interesting to me, instead of however else they would have gotten out of that, whether it's, you know, one of them straight up winning the fight, or I don't know what they would do, or just having it break up. I think it's a natural, I don't think those characters are being put together haphazardly. I think it's a nice sort of symmetry that they have where they can kind of have that interaction.
Yeah, I don't, for as interested as the show seems to be in identity, I don't know what it thinks about identity. It seems to fit into a lot of what they think of a concept. Like, they're like, if the concept is here, then that's good enough. And I don't really get a sense from either. I mean, we've talked about how Ashfaq, we're like, well, what the hell is he? Like, the show doesn't seem to know what he is. Yeah. So his conflict doesn't mean anything to me, because I can't relate to his, what he thinks he is now, as opposed to what he was before. It would actually just be easier if he was whole Klingon before, and now he just looks different, but has a Klingon mentality. Yeah. But it's not that. He's something entirely different. And Culber is the same. The only thing they've done with him is that he says, I feel different. Things don't seem the same to me. And it's like, well, is that because you're a mushroom, or is that because of some kind of the journey that you went on changed you? Like, what is different about you besides the fact that you don't like the same food you used to like? And so when you have these very unimportant or like very sort of vague ideas about what their identity problems are, when they clash together, it just feels like you're sort of saying our theme is identity. And I don't know where to go with that. Like, I don't know. Maybe they'll go somewhere in the future with it. But as of this point, I didn't feel like it was really an earned fight. It felt very superficial about why they were fighting with each other.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I don't disagree with that, because it's not like a samurai standoff. It's very much a Culber lashing out kind of fight, which doesn't need to be thought. I don't think it doesn't need to be thought through that much, because, I mean, just based on the fact that this is the guy who broke his neck and killed him.
Yes.
I think that's enough for him to want to beat the shit out of him.
You know, I would have been better with him just sort of cheap-shotting him in the mess hall and then walking off. You know, like the...
I don't know. I feel like it's worth more than that, especially because if you are... If the argument that he's giving you back, if the guy who murdered you... The argument is that wasn't me, that was the Klingon who lives inside of me. I'd be like, then bring him the fuck out, because I'm going to punch him in the fucking nuts. You know, so I can understand. You know, it's like when people get into fights with Bruce Banner, specifically trying to make the Hulk come out. You know, that kind of thing. I can understand that level of aggression towards him. What I think they need, or hopefully will have, is I think Ash has more work to do in this story than Culber does. I think, because there has not been an interaction from Ash's side where he has addressed to Culber his feelings about what happened, at least not that I can remember.
About killing him, you're talking about.
Yeah.
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 Well, they haven't talked at all about it, right? It's just
right. As far as I know, this is their first interaction. So I think what needs to happen is, I think Ash needs to have some sort of resolution on his own end about what exactly it means, what exactly his actions mean. And from a way I think that you're talking about, where they haven't really pinned down what he is. And so it's difficult to explain away his actions, because if he's not Voke and he's not Ash and he's something new, then like, where does he lie in culpability for what he did? Right.
Right.
So I think part of what he needs to do is have that scene where he kind of comes to that realization or something like that. Because he can't, I think part of his character has to be, you got to stop. I mean, you're in a shitty position. You were turned into this monster. But at a certain point, you have to stop blaming the other half of you for things that you've done, because you're still doing them. So you need to reconcile who you are and the things that you've done before you can really move forward as a character. And I think, so obviously reconciling that with Culber is going to be the linchpin for that, I think.
The other interesting thing about that fight scene is it brings the third character in, which is Saru, who lets them just beat the shit out of each other.
Yep.
I thought that storyline was good and interesting in the development for Saru. They did the typical Discovery thing of, after it was over, he explains to Pike what exactly we just saw with him, which is annoying, where he's like, yeah, because I now feel very confident in my abilities and I'm no longer a prey species. I prefer to let people just kick the shit out of each other.
I I really like that the end of that interaction, because you could, like, after Pike is like, hey, let's follow the rule book next time, Saru's like, yeah, no problem. And then Pike walks away. It was almost like you could hear him go, pussy, to Pike as he walks away. He
takes his fingers, crossed fingers out from behind his back. I applaud the script for actually doing something like that, which feels very, very first timey for this series, where they actually layer stories on top of each other. Like, things are crisscrossing in a very satisfying way.
God forbid
way.
Your characters act in a way that are consistent with their character.
Right. And that you've been developing them too. And I think that that's really the main strength of what I think that the episode does. And I think it still has a lot of Discovery weirdness to it. The one thing I'm sort of curious, or what I was thinking about, is why does, I don't know if they're going to explain this, but why does Section 31 fake the fact that Spock killed guards to escape?
Yeah, as far as laying out mysteries that people should care about, I'm more interested in that than I am in what the fuck Burnham said to Spock. And the fact that at no point did anybody say, well, why would they want us to think Spock killed somebody?
Right. Why can't they just track him down as a black ops group? Why do they have to have a crime committed that would draw attention to him?
I guess, depending on, I guess that's a mystery of the show that is yet to be explored. However, I feel like, if that's what you want to people to focus on, you got to have someone in the show focus on that a little bit.
Mm.
And nobody seems particularly concerned by it.
Well, I think they could just drop it and not go back to it. Like, I think it's one of those things that they could probably just be like, yeah, we'll just hand wave that away and not think about it. And then
I think they could, but I don't think that they will. I think that's going to come back,
okay,
because that's too much of a, that's a big deal to have an APB out on Spock as a murderer and then to find out he didn't kill anybody and have Spock specifically say, does it look like I killed anybody?
Right.
That sounds like something that's going to come back. I don't know why. We'll see. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much weight they put on that moving forward, because I feel like as far as mysteries go, like I said, that's a bigger deal than, honestly, take out the Burnham shit. Like the split between the two of them, make that your mystery for the season.
Yeah.
That's way more interesting as far as I'm concerned. If they had nobody has cameras in Star Trek, I guess. So maybe they don't have,
cameras. Yeah, the fight scene with George Zhao and Burnham.
If they had managed to find partially scrubbed security footage of Spock taking out those guards at the beginning of the season, and it was like, oh, fuck, he didn't kill anybody. And now you're going up against Section 31, who's got this APB out on a murderer.
Yep.
But you know he didn't kill anybody. That gives you more of an excuse, I think, a more legitimate excuse to have this sort of race to find Spock. Because as it stands, we don't really know what the fuck Starfleet wants with him, right? Other than the fact that he's a quote unquote fugitive.
No, they want what I thought was an interesting turn of phrase. He says, my memories of the future, which is kind of just a ridiculous word play for my premonitions, that he's like my visions. They call them memories of the future because they think that sounds more profound.
My apocalypse.
Yeah. But I think that I'm a little concerned with how they're portraying Starfleet here.
Yeah, very
very Section 31-y. It seems like Discovery is the only on the up-and-up crew out of everybody, where I could be fine if Section 31 was alone in this sort of like, we need to find Spock to find these answers, but they have that scene with the admirals where the admirals are like, do whatever's necessary, we need to get him.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I also don't know why you end your, obviously, we'll see next week, but I don't know why you end your episode with, we need to get as far away from Section 31 as we can, and then your preview for next week is, welcome to the Section 31 base, Discovery. And it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, we're going to the base.
Also, not to make too many heads explode here, but I think there's a larger canon problem that I don't know if anyone's brought up yet, which is that technically what we're seeing, what Spock is seeing from this possible future does not take into account that the prime timeline that we know of is already the alternate timeline.
No, sure.
Thanks to the events of
yesterday's Enterprise.
Yesterday's Enterprise. Because as we learned from that episode, the dark timeline is actually the prime timeline. And I'm not making this up because I am 100% correct. The dark timeline is the prime timeline. And so anything that happens past that is already in an alternate timeline. So does this Red Angel come from the quote unquote real timeline? Or does it come from the timeline that we believe to be the prime timeline?
That captain from the Enterprise C. She's come back. It's a woman. Therefore, that makes sense. And it connects.
I hope it's just Kelsey Grammer.
Should we end with the Red Angel thing? I guess. I think listener Kyle has properly identified what I think is going to happen here. I don't know if you had a chance to read it on the Discord yet.
But I don't think I did.
So there's this destructive force of the future, right? That's going to wipe out all sentient life by launching missiles at planets or whatever. Kyle theorizes that it is Section 31's control AI that they keep talking about that goes haywire, and you know, it's the typical sort of
I saw that thing, but I didn't know what he was talking about. This control AI thing is something I just missed.
Okay, they've mentioned control. Are you familiar with they keep saying control? Section 31's control?
Honestly, no. Okay. I have not been picking up on that.
They've mentioned that in a handful of episodes this season. This was the first episode where Georgiou, after the scene with the admirals, explains that the control is actually an artificial intelligence program. It's a threat assessment program.
Okay.
And so
I do remember there being a comment about taking orders from an artificial intelligence or something like that.
That's what she's talking about.
Gotcha.
And that would tie into the sort of what's the currently fashionable AI thing would be like, and then the AI, while trying to live up to its programming and protocols, actually does something catastrophic to people. And I could see that being the case here, where in an effort to sort of protect everyone, it realizes the best way to protect everyone is to destroy everyone. Red Angel is trying to offset that for one second. What's that?
So I was going to say, let me stop you there for one second. So does this mean that we're going to have a logic battle between Spock and a supercomputer over? Because that's a very logical decision.
That's a very canon thing to do. I think it would be faith versus reason, where the machine is acting on faith.
Because you've got the machine whose logic extrapolation says the best way to like you said, the best way to protect everybody is to destroy everybody. So then you need someone like Spock who can counter that with a better logic argument.
Right. Yes. And that launches
just
him.
Just take a page out of The Prisoner and just ask it why, and then watch it self-destruct.
What does God need with a starship?
So is there a Red Angel component to that theory?
The Red Angel is just the entity that's trying to stop this from happening, which seems more obvious. Yeah.
But I didn't know if there was a theory. I mean, the prevailing theory seems to be that it's Burnham is the.
I thought the scene where the Red Angel, scene where Spock mind melds with the Red Angel in this, it cuts very quickly between him and Burnham doing the same pose, looking.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of an implication. It's Burnham. I don't know if Burnham's very satisfying. And again, as I mentioned last time, I'm not super into the speculating, but I do think Kyle was correct, and that seems the most logical outcome to me.
I thought that too about that scene, but I also feel like that might have been a red herring because I don't know, it just seems too easy. Like why would Burnham be the Red Angel? For what purpose? Like, how does she get to the future, first of all?
Yes.
And why her to send back as opposed to it's probably the robot girl. Oh, no, she had said it was human, so it couldn't be the robot girl.
I was looking at her character thing. The producers have called her an augmented human.
Yeah.
So she's kind of a cyborg. So it could be that person, although I think that Arium, what they're saying, is going to get infected by the control AI of the future. And yeah, I don't know if she would be trying to fix things at that point. Who knows? We're really getting into speculation territory here, but I just wanted to touch base about it.
the Burnham is the Red Angel, sure, I guess. I feel like that is ultimately unsatisfying, and I'm not going to say anything else, because I think it's unfair to call something unsatisfying until you've seen how they do it, so.
Mm. Yeah, we'll get to it. But it looks like Arium gets revealed next episode because she's choke slamming everybody. So
yes. I do want to say one thing, though,
mm-hmm.
unrelated to that, but back to the Talosian stuff. When, what the hell's her name? Lena?
Vina, I think. V-I-N-A. Vina.
When Vina and Pike had their, like, talk, and he's like, he's saying, she says, you never really left. They created a version of you for me to live with, or some shit like that. Was I the only person who was hoping when she said, there's something I need you to see, it was going to be like, this is our ghost child? I was really hoping it was going to be like, this is our family.
This is our,
this is your ghost son.
This is our illusionary son. Yeah. I was surprised we didn't see illusionary Pike in the caves with
her. Yeah. The other thing I would like to say that I'm happy they did finally is they actually worked a visual or sci-fi gimmick that they bring to the beginning of the story into the resolution. Because when they beamed them out and she's like, you got to let them go. And then they beam them onto the Section 31 ship.
Yeah.
I 100% thought that that was just for real. Because let's put it this way. In my head, I'm going, oh, yeah, obviously, yeah, that's fake. The Talosians did X, Y, and Z. Those are fake people they beamed aboard. But then I thought about this show, and I was like, well, no, because it might not be, because that would totally be in line for the show to forget that they have that capability and just actually not use that in this situation.
Yep.
Because I was already in that mode of thinking, because they show up to the when Burnham and Spock show up to Talos IV, they have to fly into a fake black hole because the Talosians are hiding themselves so much.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like focus just off focusing on Spock and Burnham so they couldn't do the same thing when the Discovery and the Section 31 ship showed up?
Oh, I see what you mean. Right. Why didn't they go back to the black hole idea?
Yeah, or something. Like, I was really surprised that both of those ships showed up and there wasn't any sort of like fake deflection being put up by them. But,
yeah,
you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point. It had to work out this way, I guess. And
at least they used it eventually.
I think they I think that's a strength of the script, actually. Like, it's like it is paying things off that it's introduced early on, and I think that it's a close,
like, you know, stories are supposed to do.
I'll close it by before we go to break, I'll just say, yeah, it was probably one of the more structurally sound episodes. I still had some problems with it, but I think it's one of my stronger episodes of the season. But let's take a break. I'm going to play an audio clip. We're going to come back, and we're going to give our final thoughts about If Memory Serves.
Why the black alert?
We have to get to Talos IV to retrieve Spock and Burnham, but our spore drive has conveniently gone down, and it wasn't an accident.
You think someone tampered with it? Who would do that?
Well, we might be able to narrow down the list by asking who had a vested interest in keeping us here.
And someone on our ship has been sending unauthorized, heavily encrypted subspace transmissions to unidentified recipients.
I don't know anything about unauthorized transmissions.
Odd. They were authorized by your command codes.
All right. So we'll see where this goes from here. But I thought that this was a pretty good Discovery episode.
Is there a consensus as to why people online hated this episode?
No.
Is it entirely Talosian-based?
Probably. The reviews that I saw that didn't like it tended to focus on the Talosians, and it's kind of one of those wishy-washy things. I think it was the episode before this I wasn't crazy about, but the critics seemed to like more than I did, and this seems to be the opposite. I don't think there was a theme. I think it's like all the problems that were brought up in the reviews were typical Discovery criticisms, and it just seemed to rub people the wrong way in this episode more than some others. I mean, I think that some of the reviews I was seeing were the Talosians were too obviously just sort of fan servicey, and I thought they were better than that. Like, I thought they had a reason. It's not like they were great or anything, but I thought that they had a reliable reason for them to exist in this storyline, and their presence made sense to me.
Yeah, as someone who doesn't particularly care about that, I thought they were fine. Like, I wasn't offended by their presence. I mean, I'm aware of where they come from.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't seem out of place for them to be there, I guess.
Yeah. They fixed his head and they resolved the Burnham sure, thing for no particular reason. I mean, it's clunky. That's clunky and stuff. But I think that in general, it just everything kind of worked well here. Even if I have problems with some parts of it, and I think that some parts work better than others and some characters are better drawn than others. But the other goofy thing, the thing that made me laugh the most was at the end when Tyler is like, hey, what's going on? And they're like, you sabotaged the spore drive. And then Saru comes over and he's like, and you sent out these messages. He has a line that I thought was kind of funny. He says, we have these unauthorized communications that were authorized by your authorization codes. And it's like, what the fuck does that mean? Like because they've identified him as being the sender of the message, but doesn't that mean that they were authorized to be sent because he's kind of a senior officer? I thought it was a funny turn of phrase that they were using.
Yeah, that's kind of probably going to take another pass at that one.
I mean, that Saru thing felt really like we need one more bit of information to nail this guy because it comes out of nowhere. He just pops up and says, this is some information.
That's fine, but I mean, you probably could have worded it a little cleaner than that.
Well, I mean, you don't think it would have been nice to have a scene before where Saru is like reviewing some computer terminal, his eyes open, like, what the hell is this kind of thing? Like,
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's always better than... I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like... they had this mole plot that they didn't really pay any service to. Like in most other shows, that's something they're going to do for a good portion of the episode. And this was just sort of like tossed off as a kind of given lip service, I guess is the way to put it. But,
if this was a worse episode of Discovery, it would have happened for no, that twist would not have been impactful. Yes. You know, like they did tie it into the overarching story here, which is why I think it's different from what Discovery usually does.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that they do enough with Tyler because it's about Tyler being fucked over.
Yes.
And I think they do enough with Tyler in this episode from a character standpoint and the way that people are interacting with him that when this stuff does come up, it makes sense that they're going to blame him for it. You don't have to do any as many backflips or spend as much time on this story because it's not really the point of the story.
Right.
The episode is not about a mole on the ship. It's about other stuff, and this happens to be part of it. And they do the work with Tyler, fortunately, in this episode, so it doesn't just come out of nowhere.
Yeah. All right, I think we're done. We're going to be back next week with another Discovery episode. But yeah, I thought this one was pretty good. Solid little outing for Discovery and held my attention and everything like that. You guys can... follow us on social media. There's Facebook, Twitter, and Discord if you want to join the conversation. You want to read more of Crazy Kyle's theories. You can also support the show on patreon.com/thepenskyfile. You can go to the PayPal link. Go ahead.
What if the Red Angel is Vina? People have a meltdown?
I mean, it wouldn't be... I'd be like, well, they introduced her in an earlier episode, so I guess this is kind of a payoff that we'd have to expect.
Or maybe it's the Admiral.
If it's Admiral Cornwall or whatever her name is, that would be good. It could also be Laurel, who we haven't seen in a while. That's a potential.
One. That would. I bet it's probably that. Honestly, it really probably is.
You can go to the PayPal link. You can go to our Teespring link, which is shirts and t-shirts and cups and stuff. You can buy that and support the show. And that's about it. Otherwise, mention the show on Reddit. Mention it on Twitter. Blah blah blah. Spread the word if you can. Don't do it obnoxiously, but. Someone says, hey, what's a good Star Trek podcast? You can say, well, I don't know if it's good, but you can listen to this one. I think that's it. Clay, do you have anything you want to say?
No. I feel comfortable going against the grain on this one and saying that I think this was one of the better episodes of the entire series, frankly.
Mm. I'd probably have it as number two, actually. I might enjoy the concept episode more of one, just because I don't know if it had to continue. That one felt very standalone-y. To me, when we were looking back on it, it was like, this is just its own little contained episode that's going on.
Yeah.
And this one ties into the arcs more.
Yeah. I think if anything, they're getting close to really pulling off something great because you've got some of these episodes that are dog drinks water so loud, that have these great visual things, you know, like your spore world shit. And that the action is really solid, but the story isn't really there. And then you've got an episode like this where the story is pretty solid. The character work is really good. but there's not really a ton of action in it. So when they eventually figure out how to put those two together, I think this show is going to be pretty solid.
Yeah. Something to look forward to.
If
this reveal works out.
No, I was just going to say if they manage to put it together.
Yes.
Sorry, that was kind of awkward.
If we have 5 or 6 more episodes, so we'll see where it goes from there.
That, at least, I feel good about that, because part of me was thinking this was like there was only like 2 more left or something like that, which then would feel more consistent, where it's like, all right, they're going to have to cram a bunch of shit into 2 episodes. But if they've got 5 or 6, I think holding out hope.
Yes, we'll see where it goes from here. But that's it, guys. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.